28 service members have died at the Fort Hood Army Base this year alone.
They also must live and work on the most dangerous military installation in the United States.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, December 10th, a look at how lawmakers are finally addressing systemic sexual assault and violence at the Army base. Also, as recreational marijuana becomes big business, a look at how to get more Black and brown Americans a piece of the profits.
It's been a combination of both just being purposely left out based on the way the law has been written, but also culturally it being something that remains in the underground because of just the way its prohibition has impacted our communities.
And we'll round out the show talking to actor Mary Holland about the holiday season comedy and her newest film, Happiest Season.
Holiday movies become part of our tradition. They become part of what brings us comfort and joy at that time of year.
In 2020 alone, 28 service members assigned to the Fort Hood military base in Texas have died by suicide, accident, or homicide. Among the dead was 20-year-old Army soldier Vanessa Guillen, who was murdered by another soldier after facing harassment on the base. Guillen's murder brought renewed scrutiny of an Army base that for years has been criticized for a culture that allowed for sexual harassment and assault and other violence, and where accountability was rare. Here's Representative Jackie Speier speaking yesterday at a House Armed Services Committee hearing where House representatives heard from a panel who investigated cases of violence at Fort Hood.
It has been a difficult year for everyone, with the raging pandemic, deep divisions, and racial reckoning facing our nation. But it has been even more difficult as a year for the soldiers and families of Fort Hood. Like the rest of us, they face a deadly pandemic, civil unrest, and extreme inequality. But unlike us, they also must live and work on the most dangerous military installation in the United States. Let me repeat that. The most dangerous military installation in the United States.
Earlier this week, Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy announced that 14 leaders at Fort Hood would be fired or suspended, and he's also announced new rules for how commanders should proceed when soldiers go missing. But whether these measures will be enough to change the culture at Fort Hood and at military bases nationwide is where we begin today on The Takeaway. Joining me now is Lieutenant Colonel Rachel Van Landingham, a professor at the Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles and former judge advocate in the U.S. Air Force. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tanzina. Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is John Ismay, a reporter at the New York Times and a former naval officer. John, thank you for joining us.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
John, let's start with you with the findings that came out this week. What did the Independent Civilian Review Board here actually uncover that was happening at Fort Hood?
Well, I think one of the most significant things they uncovered was a problem with command leadership at multiple levels. And that's reflected in the number of people who have been fired or who have been suspended in their duties. And it shows how those problems with command leadership filter down into a climate where sexual assault and sexual harassment was allowed and permissible.
Rachel, what were your thoughts on the findings?
It struck me that this was one of the most, if not the most, pointed report ever issued by an entity associated with the Department of Defense that laid the responsibility squarely at the feet of the commanders. In fact, its most striking conclusion was that, quote, there was a permissive environment allowed for sexual assault and sexual harassment at Fort Hood. And who allowed that permissive environment? The command climate. This permissive environment is just a straight up leadership failure. And it's symptomatic of leadership failure is that there was significant underreporting. What really struck me, Tanzina, was that what came through was the utter fear and distrust of the system, the fear of retaliation from fellow soldiers and from the chain of command, most importantly, and just significant deep distrust of the system that led to, and then the concerns that Fort Hood already stood out And so I'd like to get into that in a moment regarding how Fort Hood already stood out and distinguished itself from other Army bases itself. Indeed, the report showed that Fort Hood already had over a 30% higher rate of, 40% higher rate of sexual assaults from 2015 through 2020 than the rest of the Army. There were red flags all over the place. And there was the history of known problems. Climate report surveys had reported serious issues already. And yet nothing was done. It was the stark omission and silence from leadership that speaks volumes.
And John, is there something about, after we heard what Rachel just laid out there, was there something about Fort Hood itself where this type of culture was allowed to proliferate?
Well, I think one thing that was specific to Fort Hood was a lack of qualified sexual assault or sex crime investigators. Those are people employed by the Army Criminal Investigation Command, often referred to as CID, and it found that that office was chronically understaffed, under-resourced, and poorly trained. A vast majority of their enlisted special agents were straight out of their 14-week training course, and they were not qualified to carry out investigations without supervision. And it led to a line in the report where it said essentially that Fort Hood's investigative division was a training ground. So I think that that is something specific to Fort Hood. It may be the case elsewhere, but Rachel mentioned, the report specifically singled out Fort Hood for having higher numbers of sex crimes, violent felonies, assault and battery charges, drug offenses, drunken disorderly charges, larceny, desertions, and people going absent without leave. So I think that you put all these things together and you have an environment where even mundane crimes or problems are not able to be adequately investigated, reported, and then dealt with by leadership.
So, Rachel, when we look at what was announced as far as the 14 members of leadership who were either fired or demoted, a number of high-ranking officials and soldiers, including three top commanders, what does that tell us? I mean, can someone actually be fired from the military?
Well, I think what it tells us is that there are numerous individuals whose careers in the Army and the military are effectively over. And Secretary McCarthy did announce earlier this week that there are ongoing investigations, as is the par for the course when individuals are relieved from duty. So appropriate disciplinary, including criminal consequences, are needed to be taken regarding everyone that failed to just discharge their responsibilities here. But here, the consequences have to be commensurate with their individual failures. But there's a rub here, because these are structural and cultural defects that this report is identifying, and they're far larger than any one person. Of course, criminal law and disciplinary measures are grounded on individual liability. But there justifiably has to be consequences for the grotesque dereliction in allowing a culture of permissiveness. I don't think, Tanzina, that for the family that's going to be enough, and it'll never be enough. And it also shouldn't be enough for the Army either, to be frank, nor the collective armed forces. An entire system, I think, helped contribute to Vanessa's death. An entire system has helped to Vanessa Guillen and has helped contribute to this culture. And the report numerous times mentions a culture, and I think that really has to be nuanced and has to be spelled out so that actions can be taken. But there must be systemic change. I think that this report must be reviewed and scrutinized by everyone who is appointed as a uniformed leader in the United States military and in the Army, from the lowest D4 non-commissioned officers who importantly set examples for their troops, to the company commanders, to the service chiefs, to the Secretary of Defense, and to Congress. And there needs to be reform.
Is there the potential, Rachel, for any of these leaders to end up in other reassigned at other bases?
I mean, there's always that potential, but I think, for example, the two-star who was terminated, who was relieved of command, is not going anywhere. He was supposed to go to Fort Bliss, I believe, to take over 1st AD, 1st Armored Division. Their careers are over.
John, we know that Fort Hood is a particularly egregious example of this pernicious culture we're talking about, but what about situations on other bases? Is this cultural issue that we're talking about across other bases in the country?
The report goes to paint, to great lengths to say that it does not specifically state that it has found those problems at other bases, but it says they very well could be found at other bases. And I think that to Rachel's point about culture, one of the big findings of the report that actually came right at the very end was that it placed a lot of the blame for the cultural rot that Rachel described on 20 years of war since 9/11, that the Army's 2 decades of constant war has created a climate and mindset where military readiness was valued over all other responsibilities to the detriment of integrity and respect between soldiers. The report said that this could not be attributed to just one person, but rather years of neglect that failed to make a connection between the health and safety of soldiers and mission readiness. And it said that that came at the expense, particularly of females in combat units. So I think my guess is that the Army as a service at the highest levels is going to be taking a hard look across the board at all of its other units, at all the other bases, to see whether or not the findings and problems the report uncovered are present elsewhere.
We mentioned at the top that there were multiple examples at Fort Hood of soldiers dying by suicide, homicide, accident. But this one case in particular really seemed to be a catalyst. That was the death of Army Specialist Vanessa Guillen, who was murdered by a fellow soldier who then took his own life. Rachel, why do you think Vanessa Guillen's case was a catalyst here to really this report?
I think it's because she put a face on all of these deeply rooted systemic issues. She was a face. And there were so many women that are coming into the military, already in the military, families that are proud of their sisters and daughters and mothers who are wearing uniform, that it struck fear in individuals that could be one of their own, that Vanessa could have been any one of these brave women that are serving our nation and have long been serving our nation. And it was that stark concern they're going into the military to serve their country and to keep the rest of us safe. And yet the military itself, the Army itself, couldn't keep their daughter safe. And so I think really that's what Vanessa poignantly and starkly represented. And the concerns that she had, their concerns by the family that she had been sexually harassed, the Army did not find evidence of that, but of course they wouldn't, because her murderer cowardly killed himself before being brought to justice. And so I think she represented a groundswell. And it also corresponded, I think, Tanzina, a bit with the Me Too movement, which was a few years earlier, but still out there to shed light on the fact that that sexual harassment and sexual assault and sex are a huge endemic problem, and they're a societal problem. The military is reflective of society. It's a component of society. It reflects society. And there's a report from a few years ago, studies, of course, that women in America, 1 in 5 women in America have reported either being the subject of a rape or attempted rape. And then you take women and you put them in the military, where the huge gender disparity, with 84% of the enlisted personnel in the armed forces overall being men, 81% of the officer corps in the United States military across the services being men, that amplifies societal issues. And of course, sexual assault and sexual harassment are American societal issues. It's a disease that the military is trying to strike from a component of society. But it's amplified in the military, and you look at, and I think because of the gender disparities, and then you look at the fact that between 2014 and 2018, female enlisted and officers across the military were 28% more likely to leave the service than men. So you see these disparities in gender, and you see it even more starkly as individuals rise through the ranks, rise to leadership. So women do not see other women very frequently in high leadership positions, and that's a problem. And of course, there's still a problem that women don't feel like they belong. There is still a component of the hyper-masculinity in the armed forces. And it's not helped by comments by folks like the former Secretary of Defense, Mattis, who said that, you know, the jury's still out on the propriety of women in combat. Women feel devalued. And of course, men are victims of sexual harassment and assault as well. And there was an unfortunate case in this that was really striking regarding that in the report, in this week's report as well, in which the Criminal Investigation Command agents failed and inappropriately closed a report, an allegation regarding sexual assault by one male soldier against another, and then the accuser committed suicide.
We covered that story here on The Takeaway as well, and it's a very important point, Rachel, that you raised, that sexual assault does not just happen in one context. Anyone can be a victim of that. And I'm wondering, both of you, Rachel and John, have both served in the armed forces, and I'm wondering whether or not either of you have witnessed or experienced your own issues regarding assault or harassment in the armed forces.
I would say that I saw things that I was unable to recognize at the time as sexual harassment. It was a pretty rough and tumble atmosphere, a lot of the places I was at, a lot of joking that I realize shouldn't have gone on. You know, I think that the military is getting much better about recognizing what a professional environment means. The mission first mindset has been pervasive and has allowed for, you know, jokes and things to go on that I don't think would go on today, or that people would be more quickly recognizing as inappropriate. And, you know, I'm ashamed to say that I didn't recognize that at the time.
Rachel, what about you?
I have to say, of course, if you look at the numbers, it's hard not to be a woman in the military and not have experienced both sexual harassment and sexual assault. I mean, I showed up for basic training at the United States Air Force Academy 2 months after turning 18 in 1988, for Ronald Reagan was still president. And it was frankly awful. I wanted nothing to do with the Air Force once I graduated from the academy. But it was better in the real Air Force, not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but better. And then to my gratification, almost 18 years after graduation, I was able to go back and actually teach and help lead a department at the U.S. Air Force Academy. And I was floored by the changes. And it's really, I think, the younger generations coming up are bringing such a different mindset to all of these problems. And that's what this is going to take. It's going to take getting out all of the old guard, bringing in these fresh new generations that have much greater sense of gender equities, sexual orientation equities, fairness and equality. And I think that I agree with John that things are definitely changing, but there's definitely things to do. And I would like to mention the reform movement. There's legislation sitting on Capitol Hill right now that can help move the ball forward. There's I Am Vanessa Guillen bill that was introduced in the fall. I mean, it deals with things like providing a separate restricted reporting channel for sexual harassment that already exists for sexual assault. But sexual harassment has been shown to be a potential precursor for sexual assault. So things like that, things like removing commanders who have shown that they have failed on this issue time and time again from the prosecutorial decisions, right? To help install trust and reinforce trust in the actual system. So there are structural things that can be done that will not solve the overall societal problem, but I think will definitely help improve the situation.
John, in the coming days and weeks, is there anything else we should expect to see from the Fort Hood investigation?
I think you're likely to see more guidance, specific direction given from the Army Chief of Staff or the Secretary of the Army. What we have right now is a report that people are reading and internalizing. What I have not seen yet, and it may be happening internally, I grant them that, it could be that they're so busy, you know, generals and other leaders are so busy addressing this internally with their troops, with their soldiers, that they haven't yet spoken externally about it, whether via press releases or via social media. But I have not seen publicly senior leaders speaking about this is exactly what we're going to do. I haven't seen, okay, everybody at this division or this corps, this, you know, battalion, whatever, we're going to sit down and talk about this today before everyone goes home. And then in a week, you know, say, subordinate commanders, you present me your plan for what you're going to do at your level to address these issues.
John Ismay is a reporter for the New York Times and a former naval officer, and Lieutenant Colonel Rachel Van Landingham is a professor at the Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles and former judge advocate in the U.S. Air Force. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
According to an FCC broadband progress report, about 19 million Americans do not have access to broadband internet at home, and 14.5 million of those Americans live in rural communities. To combat this digital divide, the Federal Communications Commission announced $9.2 billion would be given to hundreds of internet providers to help bring faster internet to rural areas. Joining me now to talk about the FCC's latest announcement is McKenna Kelly, a politics reporter at The Verge. McKenna, thanks for being with us.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So when it comes to rural America, which regions and communities are most affected by the digital divide?
Right. Well, it's all across the country. It's people from Maine to Texas to Iowa and California. It really touches basically every state in the country.
So McKenna, when it comes to the digital divide, particularly in rural communities across the country, what is leading to that? I mean, what's contributing to the lack of internet access? Is it structural?
Right. So it really comes down to the fact that it costs so much money for telecom providers, or they say so at least, to put up any infrastructure to connect people. When I was in Iowa in February covering the digital divide, I was talking to telecom providers who were telling me they could lay down a mile of fiber and only connect one family. And connecting a mile of fiber can cost thousands and thousands of dollars when you're only supposed to charge a family, right, like maybe $60 a month for internet. So the problem here is that they don't make the return on investment.
Hmm. How has the pandemic made this issue even more intense?
Right. So it touches everyone who's not connected right now. If you are able to work from home, but you don't have internet home, that's stripped away from you, right? Children all across the country, if they don't have Chromebooks, if they don't have internet at home, it really shows the divide there for families. So the pandemic has really just kind of shone a light on all the disparity that there always has been, but just made it more apparent for some folks.
So the FCC is going to spend $9.2 billion to help rural communities get access to the internet, but they're not giving it to community members themselves, right?
Right. So the way that a lot of the programs at the FCC works and how they kind of send a lot of subsidy money to get people connected to the internet and, you know, just getting money to telecom providers to put up infrastructure later, it works through kind of an auction process. So the money goes directly to telecom providers who will then put up towers or lay fiber or do whatever they decide to do with it in order to get people connected.
McKenna, a couple things happening now. This Trump administration is winding down. The FCC head, Ajit Pai, is supposedly stepping down at the end of Trump's term, which is in January. Who's up next?
Right. So we don't really know who Biden plans to appoint as the next chairperson of the FCC. That hasn't been announced yet. But we do know who the next Republican commissioner is going to be because he was confirmed this week by the Senate. His name is Nathan Symington, and he was nominated earlier this year by Trump.
So can Symington be confirmed prior to a Biden administration? And if so, what would that mean for the Biden administration?
So Symington was confirmed. And the thing here is that he can be. Donald Trump is still the president. The Senate can still act on nominations. But it is kind of untraditional in the way that it happened this week. For the past couple nominations to the FCC, the Senate has paired Democrats and Republicans together. That way, the commission gets both Democrats and Republicans on the same at the same time. And this week they just voted on one Republican, which caused a lot of Democrats and advocacy groups to get really upset.
McKenna, does the Biden administration have a vision for what its FCC would be?
So they haven't said a lot, but from what I've gathered throughout, you know, the past 2 years, throughout the campaign and now, is that, of course, everyone's thinking about closing the digital divide, right? Getting people connected to the internet. But another big thing for the past, oh my gosh, 10 years now, has been the net neutrality issue. And I have a feeling that as soon as the Biden FCC is able to act on it, they will probably move forward with putting net neutrality back on the table.
Some other big news coming out of Washington, the Federal Trade Commission and dozens of states have sued Facebook with two antitrust lawsuits. Tell us about how significant these lawsuits are.
So it's really significant. Yesterday when this happened, the first thing that I thought about was an old settlement with Facebook that the FTC had about 2 years ago where they decided not to pursue litigation. And now, 2 years later, they're deciding to hopefully strip away Facebook's two largest acquisitions of Instagram and WhatsApp. Just putting that in writing and asking a court to do that is major. For a lot of folks in the antitrust and tech policy world, that kind of seems like pie in the sky, you know, reversing those two big purchases Facebook's made. But the FTC is really going after it.
Well, what I think, McKenna, is interesting is that Facebook's response was that the federal government had the opportunity to voice these concerns and to prevent this from happening almost a decade ago. And so in many ways, I wonder if this is a reflection of the federal government's inability to understand what was happening before they allowed Facebook to acquire Instagram and WhatsApp, because it almost seems like why now is the big question.
So that's one of the things that's really important here. You're 100% correct. And over the past like couple of years, Congress has been coming up with plans to make the FTC stronger, to educate, put some rules of the road when it comes to tech companies and the acquisitions they're supposed to be making. It seems like in the past, nobody really understood, you know, Silicon Valley. No one really understood the tech economy, the way that it's developed today. So they're hoping to look back and kind of correct what they think are mistakes that they've made, right?
And is that Facebook's fault, McKenna, or is that the federal government's fault? I mean, to Facebook's point, they did have the opportunity to, they're going back to try and correct something that could set a precedent for other, how other tech companies and other companies, I guess, you know, decide to make acquisitions.
Right. I think you're on to it. The government definitely has had a problem with this. They have been really slow to catch up to the tech economy. We've seen this with data privacy legislation. We've seen this with antitrust legislation. We've seen this with surveillance legislation. We've seen this. The Congress and the federal government has just been incredibly slow to the tech economy. So it's hard to blame Facebook. But when you look at investigations that Congress has made into Facebook and its acquisitions, it's pretty clear when you get the documents that there was a lot of things that could be challenged in court that really does look bad on Facebook, saying emails from like Instagram folks saying that if Facebook doesn't buy them, Mark's going to go wild. Mark Zuckerberg, right? Some like vague threats. So it'll be interesting to see all of this play out. It'll be a long case and an interesting one if it goes forward.
And McKenna, I mean, what's really at issue here? Let's talk about what the federal government is concerned about. Is it just a sort of the monopoly power that Facebook could have in tech? Or is it about privacy? Is it about the fact that, you know, users who are on Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp may not know that those three companies are all connected? What's really at issue?
With the FTC, it seems like the biggest issue that they're pointing out here is the power that Facebook has in the market, right? But the thing with antitrust law is that it's bigger than monopolies, right? It's consumer welfare. It has to do with other things like that. So, of course, in these cases, I'm sure privacy will be brought up. But the main sticking point for both the states and the FTC right here is the fact that Facebook is just so large and consuming so much of probably both the ad market and like the social media tech market.
McKenna Kelly is a politics reporter with The Verge. McKenna, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, it was great to be here.
The This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Yesterday on the show, we talked about the growing support for legalizing marijuana across the United States and the cannabis industry that's showing no signs of slowing down. According to the Marijuana Business Factbook, the projected economic impact of the legal marijuana industry in the United States could reach $77 billion by 2022. But that doesn't mean everyone is benefiting from the industry's record highs. Black people and other people of color who have long been targeted by law enforcement for cannabis use are facing significant barriers breaking into the legal cannabis business today. So we spoke with marijuana advocate, author of How to Succeed in the Cannabis Industry, and the cannabis program supervisor for the city of Portland, Oregon, Deshita Dawson. And I asked Deshita, what exactly does a cannabis program supervisor for the city of Portland do?
In essence, I oversee the Office of Cannabis Program Management, all the licensing and compliance, the typical things that one would expect with owning a business within the adult use or medical cannabis market within the city of Portland. But I also oversee the community education and cannabis competency and equity programs as well within my office.
So one of the big things we've been talking about on the show as we are starting to see more movement towards decriminalizing and making even legal in some states marijuana, particularly for recreational use, is that this is a huge business. And yet only 4.3% of cannabis business owners are Black. Talk to us about some of the major barriers that have led to that.
You know, unfortunately, we've seen a huge racial disparity in the arrests while cannabis was prohibited. And one of the biggest things that was part of policy when the industry was first being developed, certainly the adult use market, starting with Colorado 10 years ago, is to prohibit individuals with prior arrests and convictions as it relates to cannabis from being in the industry. And so that this just being the policy, you couldn't be a worker, you couldn't be an owner. We see a disproportionate amount of those people being prohibited being Black, Indigenous, and Latinx. And so that's a first real cause. But also the second, I would say, would be us, you know, not bringing ourselves to the table out of fear. Again, being over-policed and most likely to be arrested for cannabis possession as compared to white counterparts, despite no more usage, it is really ingrained, multi-generationally ingrained in Black and Hispanic communities that, you know, being a anything part of marijuana is bad. And so it's been a combination of both just being purposely left out based on the way the law has been written, but also culturally it being something that remains in the underground and is frowned upon if brought to light or talked poorly about because of just the way its prohibition has impacted our communities.
Deshita, one of the most frustrating things about how marijuana policy in the country has evolved is that I often say, talk about how I grew up in the 80s here in New York City, and I recall witnessing the war on drugs, the effects of the crime bill, particularly in Black and brown communities that I grew up in, and seeing how many people were incarcerated for these crimes. And now, decades later, we're witnessing a sort of birth of an industry here that is largely concentrated among white owners and white business owners. How do we begin to get people of color the capital that they need to set up these businesses?
I think that's a great question. I'm also from New York. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. Grew up during the war on drugs. And so one thing I will say out the gate is that the industry has been going on for a decade in adult use, multiple decades for medical. And as recent as last year, there were videos of young man getting assaulted by 7 police officers because he smelled like he had been consuming marijuana. So New York City still has a long way to go. And we're still seeing a lot of the unwanted police interactions as a result of the smell. And so I still think the fear is a really big issue, but the money is another. And that actually is in a lot of ways dictated by the government. New York's medical market, for example, only granted 10 licenses, which made it extremely extremely competitive. We talk about awarding a license to do business as opposed to just having the requirements. And so the money aspect comes into being able to jump through all of the hoops that the government has set up as the requirements to get a license, how much you have to have capitalized in the bank and the like. And so then that leads us to an issue of who has the funding. And private equity funding in this country generally is run by, you know, white males, and women and people of color, specifically Black people, have a very big struggle with getting funding for projects, period. But then you add the layer of cannabis and it becomes a very difficult thing to even get funding from within your own community of people who are willing to support. We're starting to see that change a bit. And I think the government has an opportunity to take the tax revenue and really reinvest it, providing some funding. But I don't think it's going to close the gap on what the regulatory, you know, framework calls for. So we've got to do both.
There's also the question of criminal background. And what I find mind-boggling is that someone could have done their time, have been incarcerated for marijuana-related offenses, is now out in this moment where people are taking advantage of the legal market to sell and consume marijuana. And yet those people who have been convicted of crimes are left out of the market, particularly because they have these convictions. Is part of the MORE Act, for example, attempting to expunge some of these records so people can get a foothold in a market?
Absolutely. I mean, I think over the last 3 years, cannabis equity has started to be defined, and it's defined around those most adversely impacted. And we know it starts with the individuals who were arrested and incarcerated. And so most of the really top equity programs in the country, Illinois, Massachusetts, California, even what's going on in Oregon, you actually have to have that previous record to be defined as an equity designated applicant. And that can give you anywhere from funding support to prioritize processing, a lower or reduced licensing fee. So in the state and local level, we've started to just change the way we think about the legality. The policy shouldn't be that those people are left out. It should be that we should be figuring out ways for equity to really be achieved. We've got to figure out how to get them in if they want to be in. To some people may have done all that, like you said, and they actually just want to open up their, you know, their another business, but they've not been able to get approved for funding because of their past. So to your point, expungement is really important, and the MORE Act, the acronym means opportunity, reinvestment, and expungement. And that expungement piece is something it does address. You know, we've, as the regulators in the industry, have been very critical of the MORE Act, though, since its passing, because there were a lot of language that we were surprised by that does the opposite of what we've been working on in the state and local level. So it expunges at the federal level, but doesn't expunge or mandate state level expungement. And even in New York, we don't have expungement as a constitutional thing that we can do. And so in some ways, New York, you know, would need to be told by the federal government, hey, you need to create this and do it. And then there are other states that we just know would never do it. Georgia, Alabama, Kentucky, they wouldn't expunge without a mandate. And so you leave people, unfortunately, in that limbo state where they still really haven't gotten rid of their record. Because, you know, where I'm from, Brooklyn, if you got a federal case, you also got a state case. And it's like a 95-96% likelihood, especially in southern states. So we're seeing some of it be answered. But no, you know, my struggle is that we're not using common sense, you know, in our policy to fix this, even though we are admitting for the record, and that's what that historic vote did, that it should never have been illegal to begin with.
Now, the vote has a very unlikely chance of passing the Senate. The makeup of the Senate could change. We're all waiting to see the results out of Georgia to see which way the Senate goes. But it would still be a pretty close, the Senate, you know, would still be pretty close in terms of who has a majority and who doesn't, if it really hinges on one person being elected at this point. Are you optimistic that a Biden administration will somehow move forward some of the things that we're talking about at the federal level to make the act, the MORE Act, for example, less of a symbolic move and more of something that actually has teeth to begin to make some of the changes that we're talking about here on the show today?
I am hopeful. I mean, I think that Madam VP-elect Kamala Harris really, despite her history, right, like she arrested a lot of people in California, and we've in the cannabis industry called her out on it. But she came out to Colorado. She met with a lot of leaders within the cannabis industry. She gets it. And a lot of the laws she made as senator in California really has been precedent across the country. So she understands decriminalization. I think where they make the mistake is that instead of trying to free the people, they're really trying to free the plant and get us to the money faster, or the government to the money. And we need to first deal with the people. One, as just a consumer marketing expert before I got into the industry, I would say it would make the market flourish. More people from the legacy market or underground market would move over. But also, we were changing people's lives. We're making them more viable in employment, in housing, all these different things that are insecure right now due to COVID. I think that she gets that. And I think that her influence on Biden, from what I can tell, means that he's going to be getting it as well. Do I think that they are going to fully legalize? I'm not certain that he's convinced there, but they don't need to. They need to decriminalize, stop arresting people, stop making things like what happened last year to that young man in New York City happen by just having ambiguity around whether cannabis should be illegal on the federal level. And now that the World Health Organization has descheduled it and removed it from its most dangerous category, which for them is a level 4, for us it's the schedule 1. But basically, that means we have an ability and precedent to remove it. And that once it gets removed from schedule 1, it changes the federal landscape on whether we should be arresting people and using SWAT. And all of that is aligned with it being dictated as a Schedule 1. So I think we're going to get there for sure. And I think that's actually in our best interest as Black and brown folks to have it decriminalized, because, you know, the part that's really damaging us are the arrests, over-policing, the incarceration. It's removing people from the home and individuals coming out, inability to get homes and jobs. That's what's impacting our community as a whole.
The black market, Dashita, is where a lot of folks continue to get their marijuana. And I'm wondering, you mentioned opening this up could mean that people who are in the black market could then move over to the legal side of things. But I'm wondering, you know, black market marijuana will probably be cheaper than legal marijuana for perhaps a variety of reasons. And it's also a place where people have been able to make a living off of selling this on the black market. And I'm wondering how you see the black market evolving.
Well, I think it's been evolving even in states where California is the largest market, but the legacy market, which is what I call it at this point because it existed before, it really is, it's still growing, it's thriving, it's actually benefiting from the decriminalization aspect. Where the government's missing out is the ability to create programs that have people cross over from the legacy market to the legal market. And what does that mean? It means that you're probably going to have some sort of business and tax structure type of programs. But I also think, again, not having it be so many hoops that people have to jump through just to get the license. Like if I'm just a distributor, AKA the plug, do I need to get all of this federal bond, all these licenses in order for me to just distribute? I'm not sure if that should be the case. And I think there are opportunities and things that I'm doing myself within Cannabis Equity that are intended to pilot, right? We got to test. We don't know what's going to happen without trying it. But to date, we haven't tried to actively just move the demand over by moving the market over. Instead, we've tried to just hyper-criminalize that market. That's not going to work. Our usage rate has not changed in 40 years, despite some of the harshest drug laws in the world.
And that usage rate, it should be noted, as you know, Dashita, that black and white Americans use marijuana at similar rates. It's just black and brown Americans are criminalized for it more than white Americans are.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, I think that in of itself is the story behind cannabis. And when people of color actually recognize it, I think it changes their perspective that when you're getting involved, yes, there's a business opportunity, but there's a real justice component for the people who were most adversely affected and directly affected. But even for people like myself, I was never arrested, but I grew up and I watched people get dropped to the ground, you know, for a dime bag. And that to me, I think has a psychological effect on how we think about cannabis. And that ultimately is impacting our health, because at the end of the day, this is actually medicine. We're talking about an adult use market, right, or recreational, but the reality is the plant is still always medicinal, regardless of the usage rate. So it's a little bit of a personal fight for me as well as a cannabis patient. We need these markets to do better, and I think we'll do better by including the diversity that exists in the legacy market.
Dasheeda Dawson is the author of How to Succeed in the Cannabis Industry and the Cannabis Program Supervisor for the City of Portland, Oregon. Dasheeda, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me again. I appreciate the conversation. It was great.
And we're going to round out the hour with some holiday cheer. This winter, many of us won't be able to gather with our own friends and relatives, but we can still watch other families celebrate in holiday movies. And the longing for a normal winter night may be one reason that the new Hulu movie Happiest Season has connected with so many audience members. The film hits many of the classic holiday rom-com beats, but also manages to modernize the genre by centering on a same-sex couple, Abby and Harper, and they're played by Kristen Stewart and Mackenzie Davis. Harper brings Abby home for Christmas, but hasn't come out yet to her family. Happiest Season was co-written by Clea Duvall and Mary Holland. And Holland also stars in the film as Harper's eccentric sister, Jane. Here she is in a scene from the movie greeting her oldest sister's family.
Freeze!
Ooh.
Don't move one more muscle before I hug you.
Hi, Jane.
Oh, hi! Hi, Erin.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Hi, you guys. Hi. Gosh, you're so big. What are you, college students?
We're in elementary school.
Yeah, no, I know. You're just so tall, you know.
I spoke with Holland about Happiest Season, finding joy in this dark year, and what holiday movies mean to her.
For me, and I think a lot of people feel this way, holiday movies become part of our tradition. They become part of what brings us comfort and joy at that time of year. And also, like, as a kid growing up, they were such a formative part of humor. I feel like Home Alone was one of the first comedies I ever saw. I think I was like 7 or 8 when it came out, and it was just so impactful and informative for me.
A lot of people have been talking about this film in particular, and mostly because it flipped the rom-com script. It has a lesbian couple at the center and very strong gay characters. But other than that, I mean, it still is a traditional Christmas movie, right?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, that was something that Clea and I both, it was important to us that it is still so familiar to audiences of like, oh, it is what you expect from a Christmas movie. It's very warm, it's very bright, it's very joyful, and it has all those elements that people come to expect from the holiday rom-com genre, but it's just told through this new perspective.
Do any of the family dynamics in the film, like your role as sort of the outcast sister, if you will, do those resonate with you?
Well, yes. Jane is very close to my heart. When we were writing those characters, populating Harper's family, deciding what her family was going to be like and the types of people that would be in it, we knew we wanted her to have sisters. And for one of them to have a very different energy than the rest of the family. And as soon as we decided that, I said to Clea, I want to play her. And so we pretty early on knew that I was going to be playing her. So we wrote Jane with that in mind. And I think, I don't know how intentional this was or if it just kind of happened organically, but there's a lot of qualities about Jane that feel true of me. Like, she's a peacekeeper, always looking to help. And sometimes that's great. And sometimes that can be a little annoying when someone is just always trying to help and you don't necessarily need their help. But that's where she finds value in this family, is like her ability to fix the internet and her ability to help out around the house. So yeah, I think I definitely relate to that part of Jane, where you're looking to find your place in a certain group or a certain community, and she's just ever joyful and so herself. And that was really fun to play.
Movie theaters are not roaring back, at least anytime soon. How does that affect you as a writer?
I tell you what, every morning I wake up and I'm like, maybe they'll open today.
we can dream, right?
We can dream, exactly. I'm optimistic that they will be back in some capacity once life returns to some semblance of normalcy. But I think as a writer, you know, one of the amazing benefits of this age we're living in of these incredible streaming platforms is that you don't need to like tailor your writing style to suit a quote unquote streaming budget, because they're making huge cinematic movies, you know, that you would see in movie theaters. They just happen to be on a streaming platform. So I don't know that it changes the writing process so much, because there is still an appetite for those big cinematic blockbustery type movies, and I think, you know, even people enjoying them in their homes as opposed to in the movie theater, it's still we want to create as much of a movie experience as we can as writers.
So talking about the comedy world more broadly for a moment, in recent years, it's really been forced to reckon with its own history of racism and sexism. Are there any changes to the comedy world that you've seen that you're excited about or you're concerned about?
Yeah, I mean, I think as is happening in all, you know, facets of our lives and our society, especially this year, you know, there's so many conversations that have been long overdue, so many things that have needed to be addressed, and people and institutions that need to be held accountable, that is happening. And I feel, again, I feel very excited and hopeful that, you know, the comedy community and comedy in general will be a much more inclusive and welcoming space for everybody. I do think that there are a lot of people who take responsibility for having made this environment, you know, and some people who haven't, but I feel like in general there is a real desire amongst people in comedy to make the environment better for everybody.
And how do we do that in places like the Upright Citizens Brigade, like UCB, where a lot of folks, for example, who come through there, I know you've come through there, and a lot of the comedians that we know have come through there, at least the sketch comedians and probably most famously folks on Saturday Night Live. How do we make those spaces more inclusive?
Absolutely. Well, there actually is an organization called Project Rethink that was formed by some members of the Upright Citizens Brigade community who wrote an open letter to the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater and created this list of what they want to see changed about how the theater is run, how the classes are run, how stage time is allotted to various teams. Like they came up with this comprehensive, actionable set of steps that the theater could take to be a more inclusive, more hospitable place for everybody. And I'm so, so grateful to Project Rethink for initiating that conversation. We also had the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater had a town hall where students, performers, people at every level at the theater could express their own experiences and share what they would like to see changed in the theater. And I think that was so massively beneficial. And my understanding is that the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater is working very closely with Project Rethink upon reopening to make these changes. And I feel super excited and hopeful for that.
I mentioned we've talked to a lot of comedians on the show, but we've also talked to a lot of comedians over the course of the pandemic. Because one of the things we actually did a segment not too long ago, sort of figuring out when and how to bring comedy to this moment. You know, is it too soon? What are the limits of comedy during a pandemic? Which is, you know, we're in a very dark time right now. And I'm wondering, even though Happiest Season started filming before the pandemic had sort of really gripped the country, how do you find humor in this moment? Which I should say, I think humor is very important. It's just we're trying to figure out how to find it right now. What do you suggest?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I find that humor is often how I'm able to process more difficult things. It's how I can digest the more intense or darker things that are happening in life. And so I agree with you that it's very important. But for me, and I feel like, you know, a lot of people probably relate to this, it's more than just important. It's how we're able to metabolize the overwhelming, you know, stimuli that's entering our lives right now. Like we're in such a time of collective grief, and just it feels like we're just getting walloped all from all sides as a society and as individuals, and you know, people struggling with health, with financial obstacles. Like I think that humor is a means of digesting what's happening. And as far as like how do we make comedy out of everything, I don't know the answer to that. I just know that what I intend to do is to continue to make things that make me laugh, and seek out performers and movies and TV shows that explore ideas that bring joy to me. And in that way, I'm able to kind of digest the darker things that are happening. So I think humor is so vital in times like these.
What about you personally, Mary? Where are you finding joy or humor or even hope in this moment?
I'm finding, I seek solace in my friends and my family, of course, who, you know, we've gotten really good at Zoom, so that's been great. But I really find that we live in such a time of just phenomenal TV and amazing movies coming out. And so I have found a lot of comfort and a lot of joy in, you know, every night watching a new movie, watching it, getting into a TV show, and really letting myself be immersed in that world. That has helped me a lot. And, you know, I think I've also found a lot of joy in my pets. they're very, you know, I'm spending a lot of time with them right now, and they are so funny and so entertaining. And it's little moments of humor with these animals that I live with that has brought a lot of joy recently.
Mary Holland is co-screenwriter and co-star of Happiest Season, the new holiday rom-com from Hulu. Mary, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for us this week. Amy Walter is in tomorrow. Before I go, a quick shout out to the amazing team who puts this show together week after week. Our board operators were Vince Fairchild and Debbie Daughtry. Our directors and sound designers were Jay Cowett and Vince Fairchild. Jackie Martin is our line producer. Alexander Boti is our senior producer. The Takeaways producers are Jose Olivares, Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen Laird. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. David Gable is our executive assistant. And Lee Hill is the executive producer. And of course, give us a call about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I worry because this has become partisan and because the pain is not equally felt in all communities, there will be this tendency to accept the pain